Chances are, if you're part of a court proceeding, it is not a happy day for you. People don't generally go to court unless they have to, unless they're lawyers. Today's guest is, in fact, an attorney, and she has some stories to tell about the strong emotions, high and low, that she sees in her practice. And Margaret Claw does not practice criminal law. So no murder and assault cases for her. Not directly, anyway. Margaret Claw practices family law in the Philadelphia area, and she shares some of her many stories in the book Keeping It Civil, subtitled The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. Margaret Claw, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
Very much a pleasure. I had heard it once said by a court officer that forget murder cases, forget assault cases. The strongest emotions he'd ever seen in court came in family law cases.
Yeah, I think that's true. I actually have heard that the first courts to install metal detectors, when that first started to become a threshold to getting into courthouses, were family courts, because the most the highest incidence of violence in courthouses was in family courts. And there's also a great expression that kind of sums it up, which is that a courthouse saying, I would call it, which is that criminal lawyers see bad people at their best, and family lawyers see good people at their worst, which kind of, I believe, is accurate.
It's an interesting phrase, yeah, good people at their worst. Because is it largely in divorce proceedings? I mean, here we're talking about people who once were in love and basically tearing apart their marriage and trying to figure out who gets what.
Well, sometimes it is in divorce proceedings. I think the cases where the emotions tend to run highest because the stakes are highest are where there are serious child custody disputes. And, of course, domestic violence cases, which is sort of a separate topic because, you know, that's an area where if someone is really afraid of someone else, that's a very emotional situation and highly delicate. But I think child custody is really the area where you see the most emotion because, you know, we all care so desperately about our children, and that is the thing that really gets to people if they think that they're going to lose time with their children or they think that the other parent is not protecting them or taking care of them correctly. And that's different than arguing about financial issues, although certainly emotion can come into that as well. So I guess all around there's a lot of drama and emotion, but I think custody is really the area where you see it most intensely.
So getting into this profession, I mean, did you decide on family law as soon as you entered law school, or was it something that developed while you were there?
Well, it sort of developed before I started law school because I worked at a domestic violence organization, shelter, right out of college. Well, right out of college, I was a waitress, but I couldn't get a job. that was a job, but I'd already had that job in college, so I was a waitress, and then I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and I was fortunate enough to get a job working as a counselor in a battered women's shelter. This is in Massachusetts, where I lived in Boston. I went to college there, and I was working just helping the residents with various issues that they were facing, kind of a low-level job. And we had legal advocates there that would go to court with women to get protection orders and to help them with, like, custody cases and so forth. And I went to court. I accompanied some of the clients that I had been working with there to court with the legal advocates from the shelter. And I tell you, the first time I, stepped in a courtroom and I saw what happened and I saw what the lawyers there were doing, because I'd really never been in a courtroom before, I was hooked. Like, I said, I want to do this. I just felt it was so powerful, and the skills that lawyers had were so interesting to me that it seems like such important things that lawyers can do to help people. And I'm also, I just believe in the system, in the judicial system, and so it really called out to me that aspect of it. And I was also very interested in helping victims with domestic violence, and that's kind of when I went to law school, that's what I was thinking I wanted to do as a lawyer. And I did do that as a lawyer when I got out of law school. I did work for domestic violence organizations, both in New York and in Philadelphia, before I went into a private practice. And now, I do all kinds of family law, and certainly there are some domestic violence issues that come up, but it's not the focus of my practice. But that's really where it started.
Margaret Claw, you write that family law is on the cutting edge of our changing cultural norms. How?
Well, the definition of family is just morphing so quickly that the law can hardly keep up. You know, think about same-sex marriage. That's sort of the most obvious example to everyone, because the first court decision that we have, that which was based on a state constitution saying that it was unconstitutional under that state's constitution, and this was Massachusetts, to prohibit same-sex marriage, that's in 2004. So this is not less than a decade ago, and look what's happened across the country. And, you know, just 2 days ago, my sister state of New Jersey joined all of the states on the East Coast. Pennsylvania is an island prohibiting same-sex marriage, surrounded by states which now allow it, either by judicial decision or legislation. So that's a very big change. But there have been lots of other changes too, because the definition of what is a family is really changing in our culture. I mean, if you look at assisted reproductive technology, for instance, where you might have a sperm donor, an egg donor, a gestational carrier. You know, that's a woman who agrees to have an embryo implanted in her uterus and nurture a baby and give birth to it, but she's not biologically related to that child. So is she a mother? What is she? You know, there's all of these questions are coming up all the time. And the use of, like, known sperm donors instead of sperm banks, so that couples, gay, lesbian couples, are often having children with sperm donors that they know.
Right, so just a lot of complications making families a whole different kind of thing.
Yes.
The book is called Keeping It Civil. Margaret Claw, its author, our guest. We'll come back and talk more with Margaret and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Margaret Claw. She is a Philadelphia-area lawyer practicing family law. Her book about her work is called Keeping It Civil, subtitled The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. And these are some really interesting stories we'll get into in just a few moments. I want to let our Roseburg listeners have the reminder that after this program today in the morning, our signal will be going off the air for several hours. Some utility poles need to be replaced on the way leading up to the KTBR broadcast site. So KTBR and Roseburg off the air from about 10 this morning to about 3 this afternoon. We hope that's all it takes. If you'd like to join our discussion here with Margaret Claw on the Exchange, the phone number, the one phone number we have because of the pledge drive taking the others away, 541-552-6782, email address jx@jeffnet.org. So did this book, Margaret, essentially begin writing itself with your first case?
I don't think so. I think what happened is that after a lot of years of practicing, I started wanting to think about what I was doing in a more contemplative way, because I was just finding myself busier and busier and running from one case to the next and one court appearance to the next. And my kids grew up and they went to college, and I had some breathing room in my life that I didn't have before. And that's the point at which I thought, wow, this stuff is so interesting and people care so much about it. And people talk about family law issues everywhere, you know, from the any woman listening to this show knows that you go to the hair salon and you listen to half the conversations around you between the people in the chair and the hairdressers, and that's what they're talking about. I mean, up to the state Supreme Court. And I felt that I wanted to make time to sit down and try to capture some of these moments of things that happen inside the courtroom, between lawyer and client, between judge and lawyer, because I just think the material is so interesting. So I don't think I even thought about doing that for a long time, because I was just trying to do it. And now I've been doing it for a long time, and I have, you know, I a little bit less on my plate, having raised my children. And I started blogging. That's how I started writing about these issues. And then the blog, surprisingly, because I really just started it for myself, got to be quite popular. And then I started blogging for Huffington Post, and got more of an audience for that, and that's when I decided to try to turn it into a book.
There's obviously, because of attorney-client privilege, some changing of names and identifying facts, right?
Yes, major changing of identifying facts. I mean, everything in the book is true, with one exception, which I'll get to in a moment. Everything is true, but all the details about the people have been changed so that they're not identifiable, but the story of what happened to them is. And then the exception to the true part is that there is one longer case that's a custody trial from start to finish that weaves its way through the book, and that is a fictionalized account that I'm pulling from about four different cases that all involve the same issue. But that's actually fiction. Although it's interesting when writing it. I mean, it's completely accurate, even though the judge didn't say those particular words, because I'm making up the words the judge said, or the testimony of the mom or the dad. But I've tried so many cases like that it's actually very representative. But it is in fact fiction. I wasn't thinking of one specific person and modifying their name. I was kind of mashing together a number of cases that involve that issue, which has to do with abuse allegations against a parent and the difficulty of handling those in the courtroom where a child's very young.
That was actually a fairly effective technique, I found. The anatomy of a trial is what you're talking about. And there's anatomy of a trial, part one, part two, part three, not contiguous within the book, but scattered amongst the other chapters.
Thank you. Yeah, I thought that was a good way to try to kind of weave the book together, because it is otherwise sort of discrete pieces about different topics and different cases, and then that goes through it. I really enjoyed writing that, and I'm thinking maybe for the next book, maybe I'll try my hand at fiction.
Well, there were many twists and turns, certainly, in the anatomy of a trial case that weaves again through the book, including some moves in court that appeared to surprise the client in the case. I mean, which gets back into the real world, which is, as an advocate, do you have to do some things that your clients find harsh or distasteful or disagreeable?
Well, yes, I would say. I mean, you're an advocate for your client, and you have to zealously advocate for your client's position, but you're also an officer of the court, so you have to follow the rules of evidence and of decorum, and of you're not allowed to submit testimony you know to be false. I mean, you can lose your license for doing that. So there, and not that case involves that issue, but that is something that comes up sometimes. You know, a client will tell you, well, yeah, I have this other job on the side, but I don't want her to know about it. Well, like, I can't represent that person. If we're going into a support hearing and he wants me to not disclose that he has a second source of income, I can't do that. So, I mean, that's a conflict sometimes with clients, and sometimes it's more subtle than that. It's not. It's just that there's a difficulty of understanding why something might happen in court a certain way, and I think that's the real issue that I tried to get into in that anatomy of a trial piece, is specifically this issue about the rule against hearsay and the complexity of the situation, which is so common in family law practice, where a young child tells one parent something, but they won't repeat it to anybody else, and the parent believes what their child told them, but the parent's not allowed to testify to what the child told them. So, and there's some very good reasons for that. I mean, think about if you could like lose your custody of your child because your ex-spouse, who may hate you, fabricate something. You know, that's a possibility that happens, and so that could happen. And there's a reason for the rule against hearsay, but it's very difficult to explain that to someone who feels that their, you know, 3-year-old told them their father abused them in some way, and they want to protect their child, and no one is allowing them to say that in a courtroom. Those are tough issues, and those are tough cases, and that's why I chose to write about that issue, because I've handled it a lot.
Well, so what you have to do then is find other people who can kind of work around the edges. You can't give the picture of what the child's testimony would have been because it's hearsay, but you can kind of paint around the edges and fill in what the other people might have done or said or seen.
Right. You try to paint the picture through other witnesses and try to narrow it down so, you know, the only possible person that could have caused this injury was the father. You know, you can do that to a certain extent sometimes. Sometimes there's allegations of abuse that involve no injury, you know, no physical injury. The allegations of sexual abuse are the most difficult cases because sometimes there's no medical or physical evidence, and all you have is a child's statement to usually the custodial parent, and that's sort of the most challenging of all custody cases.
Margaret Claus, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a lawyer in practice in Philadelphia and an adjunct professor of family law at Temple University's Law School, also blogs for the Huffington Post. Her book is called Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 541-552-6782 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So the very first vignette in the book is about the woman you called Darlene. Obviously, names have been changed, with a baby, an abusive boyfriend, and a judge taking custody away. I mean, right off the bat, you give us a real, like, oh, my God, this is what happens in family law story.
Yeah, and the reason I opened the book with that is because I was interested, when I sat down to write this book, I was interested in thinking about why do some lawyers love family law and some lawyers hate family law. What is it about the practice of family law that can be compelling to some and repellent to others? And how do those of us who do love it, like me, how are we able to do it? What are the sort of mechanisms in our lives that enable us to deal with this level of emotion in our work? And so I wrote about this. So I was thinking about that, and I remembered, and this is you know, part of the writing process for me was that I remembered certain things that I hadn't been really thinking about consciously. I remembered this one case when I was a young lawyer that was this sort of watershed moment for me where I realized, like, my baby's not her baby, my life isn't her life, and I need to separate myself from my clients enough that I can go home and sleep at night, or I can't do this kind of work. And that, yeah, that case involved a young mom with a baby, which happened to be a baby girl who was exactly the same age as my younger daughter at the time. So I had a baby, a 10-month-old baby girl, and she had a 10-month-old baby girl, and she lost custody of the baby to the paternal grandparents, which was a completely unexpected result. And I felt, and she was hysterical, literally fell down on the floor outside the courtroom screaming, and I felt sick, and I spent the entire weekend like looking at my baby sleeping and crying because I was thinking about someone taking her away from me and what did I do wrong, and it was just this awful thing. And then Monday morning she called me up, and I was, you know, prepared to launch into this explanation of what we're going to do to try to get the baby back. And she told me that everything was all fixed up, and she and the father who had abused her, she had a protection order against him, she and the father had gotten engaged over the weekend because he gave her a ring, and they're all living together with his parents with the baby, and everything was fine. And so I was just, like, stunned. You know, I was really angry at her for making what I thought was a terrible decision. And then I was angry at her for ruining my weekend. And then I realized, like, I can't be angry, you know. This is, like, I can only do so much. And that baby's not the one sleeping in my crib at home. And that was really, that wasn't a real moment for me where it was a turning point. And I think any lawyer that practices in this area has to have some kind of a boundary to be able to make that distinction. On the other hand, not so much of a one that you don't care deeply about your clients, because otherwise you wouldn't want to do this kind of work. I mean, I really care, and I'm an empathetic and compassionate lawyer, I think. I mean, that I know I am, because I know personally I'm caring about what's happening with my clients. And if I didn't care, then I would do some other kind of law. because this is not a way to, you know, get rich.
Oh, really? Oh, that's good to know. The well, you know, that you just if the that particular story is described in a chapter called "The Wall," and you talk about having to keep a wall between yourself and the emotions of the cases around you. But boy, even with the wall in place, though, some of the detailed information you get in these cases is fairly graphic, it seems like.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, the thing about the relationship between a lawyer and a client in this context is you get to know people really fast. And that expression that I mentioned at the beginning about, you know, family lawyers see good people at their worst, I'm not really sure I see people at their worst, but I see them at this very raw time in their lives often. And so there's an immediacy to that relationship. You know, you get to know someone, you really get to know, like, their character. I mean, I can meet with someone for 2 hours that I've never met before, and the connection that I've made with them and what I know about their lives is stuff I might not know about, you know, my sister. I mean, it's kind of amazing. And I love that. And some lawyers, you know, wouldn't like that because it's, you know, it is involving in that emotional sense. But I love that connection. And I love then to see the transformation that people can go through during the course of when I'm representing them, especially someone that's in a marriage that they're really unhappy. They've been unhappy for a long time, which is, I think, the case with a lot of people by the time they get divorced. It's been a long road. And I feel that I'm really useful. I'm helping someone navigate this terrain that's unfamiliar to them, and I'm advising them and I'm helping them, and they come out on the other shore. And that is really satisfying to me.
Now, the subtitle, obviously, the case of the prenup and the Porsche. So I want to get into that case. But first, by talking about prenups more generally, I mean, there are very intense feelings about these, it seems like. But as a family lawyer, it sounds like you see both sides and have to.
Yeah, you know, prenups are just contracts where people decide before they get married what's going to happen if they get divorced or what's going to happen if one of them dies during the marriage. I mean, they're also like estate planning tools. And a lot of people use them for second marriages where both people have kids from their first marriage and they want to make sure that their assets are preserved for their children. And that's probably the most common kind of prenup that I personally do and see in my practice. And the other kind that I think most people think of when they think of a prenup is, you know, wealthy older guy marrying young vulnerable woman, you know, wants to make sure that she doesn't get his money. And that is certainly one type of prenup. And, of course, in the great state of California, with all the celebrity divorces and, you know, I read the same things everyone else does. When both people have a lot of wealth or the potential to create a lot of wealth soon, they're likely to have prenups if they get married, especially if the expectation is the marriage might not last a long time. Now, I'm not saying anything disparaging about California, but So, you know, they're a tool, and I don't think they're a bad tool. I think because figuring out what might happen if something goes wrong, I mean, that's what lawyers do in a lot of other circumstances. That's why people have insurance. That's why, you know, I mean, it certainly, given the divorce rate, it's not that unlikely that you would get divorced. Figuring out ahead of time how you would want that to, what that would look like, would can potentially just save you a lot of conflict down the road. And that's the good thing about them. And then the bad thing is I think sometimes they're just completely unfair. And the vulnerable person is giving up all of these protections that she has, and it's usually a she, that she has under the divorce laws that would give her a share of what was acquired during the marriage. She's just waiving all that. And then, you know, then your job as a lawyer, if someone comes in with one of those for you to review, is to try to talk the person out of signing it because there's no benefit to them of signing it.
So the key case in Pennsylvania for prenups is the Simeone versus Simeone?
Yes, Simeone, yeah.
Simeone, okay. And what happened there?
Well, that's a fascinating case to me because it's the leading case in Pennsylvania on what makes a prenuptial agreement enforceable. And that case involved a young woman, I think she was 23, she was not employed at the time, and she married an older doctor. And on the eve of the wedding, he handed her a prenuptial agreement to sign. And what that and she didn't have counsel, and she didn't, you know, she signed it like she was getting married the next day. So what that prenuptial agreement provided was that if they got divorced, her total financial recovery would be limited to $25,000. So that would be, you know, for division of any property, for alimony, whatever, 25 grand. And then I think it was about 15 years later, they were getting divorced. And at that time, he was this very successful neurosurgeon. And he also had amassed, or he had it before, which is probably why he had her sign the prenup, but it increased in value greatly in, during the marriage. He had this classic car collection. And in fact, he had, in Philadelphia, there's a, like a car foundation museum that he established where you can see all these cars. So he had this huge classic car collection worth many millions of dollars, and Mrs. Simeone was limited to the 25 grand.
Okay, let's hold the story there because we need to take a break right now. We'll come back and finish the story of the prenup and the Porsche, which is the subtitle of Margaret Clause's book, Keeping It Civil, about her practice in family law and some of the astounding cases she's seen over the years. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Margaret Clause and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Margaret Clause. She's a founding member of the Philadelphia law firm Berner, Clause and Watson. She is also an adjunct professor of family law at Temple University's Law School, writes and blogs and does all sorts of work about her practice in family law with some really interesting cases, and gathers it all up in her book called Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche, and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. Margaret Clause is our guest, and you can join our discussion on the Exchange. Phone number here, 541-552-6782, 541-552-6782, email address jx@jeffnet.org. So back to the case that set the baseline for prenuptial agreements in Pennsylvania, Simeone versus Simeone. Young woman, unemployed, marries a wealthy older doctor, and then he presents her with a prenup the night before the wedding. And so then he had amassed this private car collection is where we left things off.
Right. So he amassed this private car collection, and they're getting divorced, and she's limited to, you know, he's worth many millions of dollars and earns a ton of money, and she's limited to a $25,000 recovery. So she challenges the prenup in the courts in Pennsylvania, and she says this should not be enforced, because it is unfair. It doesn't make adequate provisions for me. And that case went up through the appellate system in Pennsylvania to our Pennsylvania highest court, the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, essentially, ladies, you got what you wanted. You want to be equal to men? We actually have a state equal rights amendment in Pennsylvania. Guess what? You're not going to get any special treatment. You can read and write English. No one held a gun to your head. You sign a contract, you're bound by it. We're going to treat these prenuptial agreements just like any other arm's length commercial transaction. You know, it's the same as going out and, you know, getting a car loan or whatever. And we're not going to give them any special scrutiny. That would be patronizing. You don't need that kind of protection anymore. I mean, it's a really interesting decision, and there's a dissent from one of the justices that says, like, wait a second, let's look at the reality of women's economic, you know, strength. This was in 19, I think the case is 1990, I should remember this, or 1992. But anyway, it's a, you know, a while ago. Let's look at the relative position of women versus men economically, and can you, Are you really serious that you think that women are in an equal bargaining position to men? But that was a dissent. That was not the majority opinion. And so that remains the law, and it's a harsh result, I think, but I also understand it. It's very clear that these are contracts like any other contracts. And that's not – I want to emphasize that anything I'm talking about here is not the same in every state. Family law is all state specific. There is no federal family law. So when I talk about this, you know, the law about prenups, that's the law in Pennsylvania. And many states have a different approach to prenuptial agreements, and they do give them some kind of extra scrutiny to see if they provide adequately for the dependent spouse is usually how it goes. So if you know someone is cut off entirely and gets nothing, that would not be enforced because it would be determined that it's just too unfair. So they're not looked at like commercial contracts, which, you know, you could bargain for anything you want and you're stuck with it.
So the way you characterize it in the book, though, is that because of this this ruling in Pennsylvania, that basically the groom can give a prenup to the bride as she walks down the aisle, and it will still be binding if she signs it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are specific defenses to the enforcement of a contract, which have nothing to do with a prenuptial agreement, but at any contract that every law student learns in their contract class. And you know, one of them is duress. They're like fraud. You know, you give someone something to sign and you told them it was something else. They didn't know what they were signing. Or duress is one. And the argument has been made many times unsuccessfully in our state that it would be duress to give somebody the agreement when they're walking down the aisle. And the courts have said, no, that's not duress. There's a definition that goes way back in common law definition of duress, and it really is a gun to the head. It is not psychological duress. It is physical duress. And so there's really no defense to that can be raised. The only one actually would be that there was a lack of disclosure. There has to be disclosure of the assets. And so, you know, Dr. Simeone had a list attached to that prenuptial agreement that said, this is what I own. So she knew what she was waiving. And that is important. But aside from that, yep, walk down the aisle, hand someone the prenup at the altar. They could sign it.
Wow. And then, of course, there's a lot of cases in the book that are not really worth giggling about. And in one particular, the chapter called Stefan, what happened there?
Well, that was sort of my lowest moment as a lawyer because I had a client that I represented I got a protection order for her against her husband who had been somewhat abusive to her, not extraordinarily violent, no, you know, medical treatment or anything like that. And I represented her in court. We were filing for divorce, and I also got her a protection order because he'd been stalking her. And then he murdered her, and he murdered 2 days later. He murdered her and her mother, who were at her. They went back to the apartment that they had shared. He had been evicted from it under this protection order. She and her mother were there packing all her stuff because she was actually moving. Her mother had come up from Florida to help her. And he came and broke in, and he killed them both. And, that was, like, the worst thing that's happened to me. I felt powerless and terrible, and, like, I wish I had done something different than what I did, even though, you know, there was really nothing I could have done. But I still, it was just very, very difficult. And what I learned from that, the legacy of that case to me, is that there is no way to predict the risk of harm you can't assess the threat of domestic violence, basically. If somebody tells me, I'm afraid for my life, I think he might kill me, I would never say to that person, you know, nothing really bad has happened in the past, so I don't really think there's a serious risk of that. I mean, I wouldn't say that anyway, but I might have thought that before.
Mm-hmm.
I had an internal dialogue. Well, this person got, like, thrown down the stairs. Like, that is really serious. This person just got, you know, slapped once. So there is no correlation to me anymore. I would treat any domestic violence case as potentially lethal because that case did not have severe violence in its history. And this guy came to court, smiled, shook my hand, signed an agreement for a protection order, made a provision about how they're going to divide up their furniture. I mean, this was, and then 2 days later, he committed a double homicide. So it was very unsettling to me in every way, but.
And he was caught and did serve time, is that right?
Yes, he's in prison for life. Mm-hmm. He's not getting out. There's life without parole in Pennsylvania, and that's where he is. And, yeah, so, but that's really the lesson of that you can't ever say, oh, well, I don't think this is that severe. You just don't know.
Mm-hmm. That's a hard lesson to learn. But
some
other lessons here that you certainly give the readers here, which is about, for one thing, adoption and birth certificates. I think you may blow a lot of minds with this. What happens?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Jeffrey, because anyone that's adopted a child or is adopted already knows this, but I don't think anyone else does. And when I first started doing adoptions, I was shocked by this, that when you adopt a child, the last thing that happens after the adoption is that you get a new birth certificate. And it's an amended birth certificate, and it says that you and your partner, husband, wife, whatever, you know, whoever's adopting the child, it lists you as the parents at the date of the child's birth, like you were there, like you gave, it's a totally phony document. I mean, you weren't there, you didn't give birth to the child, you're adoptive parents, and it obliterates the identity, the actual, you know, biological identity of the child's parents or parent. There might only be, you know, might only be a mom on the birth certificate, but there might be both. And that just, like, strikes me as so bizarre that the government is in the business of creating these false identity documents. Like, they're just completely false. They're, you know, and but people that are adopting kids, like, they're really excited to get these birth certificates.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting to me. I mean, I think it harkens back to an era when adoption was such a stigma, and it's the whole, I mean, there's a huge movement to open up birth records for adult adoptees, and I don't know, actually, in California, like, what the state of the law is on that, but there are many states that are, there are these, you know, grassroots organizations that are trying to change the laws so that you can get your original birth certificate if you're an adoptee, but I think it's kind of anachronistic. I don't think it fits with contemporary society, and the whole culture about adoption is really changing because now there's a lot of open adoptions where birth parents are actually selecting adoptive parents, that they know each other and they have a relationship, and maybe the birth parents have ongoing contact with the child after adoption, and it's just a different way of looking at adoption as opposed to, you know, there was a stigma, it was secret, it was shameful almost, you know, a number of decades ago. And actually California has this new law that a child can have more than two parents, which was signed into law in this month to under certain circumstances. So that's, like, really interesting. Mm-hmm. That's a first in the country.
So more changes on the way, but it sounds like you really love what you do.
I do. It's so interesting.
It really is. The book is called Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. Margaret Clawe wrote the book, and she's been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange today. Margaret, thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Very good to have you.